Then the Tea Party came in, and for the first time, people lost elections over spend too much. I didn't think you could lose an election over spend too much. I thought you had to wait till spend too much became tax too much, then we'd get you.
Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie with Reason TV, and today we're talking with Grover Norquist. He's the head of Americans for Tax Reform, and he is at the white hot center of deliberations over the fiscal cliff. Grover, thanks for joining us.
Absolutely.
You have been called an Ayatollah in recent weeks, an Ayatollah, a terrorist, an evil warlord. Jacob Weisberg of Slate, who co-wrote a book with Robert Rubin, tweeted, Hanukkah, Ceausescu, Mubarak, Norquist. Writing at the Huffington Post, Daryl Rowland talked about you as a Rasputin-type figure or like Cardinal Richelieu. What do you make? Are you offended that when you're ranked with history's greatest monsters that they don't also throw in Jimmy Carter?
Look, this is fascinating because I offer people a taxpayer protection pledge, and it's a pledge from a congressman, senator, presidential candidate to the American people, to the people of their state, saying, I will not raise your taxes. I'll go to Washington, reform government, cut spending. When I run into a problem, I'm not raising taxes. That's what it is.
Okay, and the actual text of your basic pledge is, sure, has 2 points. One is that you have a legislator or a candidate sign an oath saying, I oppose any and all efforts to increase marginal tax rates on individuals or businesses. And the second part is that you oppose any net reduction or elimination of deductions and credits unless matched by further reductions in tax rates.
Technical way of saying no net tax increase.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah.
You can reform it all you want, right, as long as at the end of the day it isn't a Trojan horse for higher taxes.
Right.
So we offer this pledge to candidates. Many of them take it. 90%+ of all the Republicans in the House and Senate have made this commitment. 15 governors, 1,000+ state legislators.
Any Democrats in that?
Oh, yes, yes, several. Over time, usually Democrats just before they switch to become Republicans, mm-hmm, or just before they get defeated in the next election.
Okay.
But there have been several who've taken it and kept it for some period of time. I think we're down to one in the House right now. The others have most recently been defeated. That's for breaking it. That said, no Republican has broken the pledge in Washington, D.C. for 22 years, mm-hmm, since 1990, when a number followed Bush and they broke that commitment. Republicans sign the pledge because they don't wish to raise taxes. The Democrats and the people who attack me as Rasputin think that these Republicans truly want to raise taxes. They lust after raising taxes. They have signed the pledge for some odd reason. And the only thing keeping them from raising taxes like they really want to is that I would call them names. It's so mixed up, it's silly, but if you're the left, you don't want to say the American people don't want larger government, they don't want to pay for bigger government, and this is thwarting our plans to give them bigger government, so you attack me personally?
Well, in terms of the spending equation, one of the reasons why you came into the news again is because people like Lindsey Graham, the Republican senator from South Carolina, and a couple of other people said, well, you know what, I signed Grover Norquist's Americans for Tax Reform's tax pledge, but that was so long ago when I was young and green, and now I'm older and wiser, and we're not beholden to you. Are you expecting a lot of Republicans to bust the tax pledge as we come closer to the fiscal cliff?
I don't think so. You've had the same collection of several congressmen and senators, Lindsey Graham always at the front of the line, saying, I might raise taxes if you gave me a gajillion dollars in spending restraint. If you actually listen to his conditions on what it would take to get a tax cut, I had a long conversation with him on the phone after he did this a year or so ago. And he said, oh no, I'd only vote for a tax increase if, and then he got, trillions of dollars in unrefundable, untakeawayable spending restraint. And I said to him, Senator, I'm officially not worried about you. Mm-hmm. No Democrats ever offering you the trade you're talking about.
Right.
So, Republicans are not interested in raising taxes. Some fantasize that there is a gift of the Maggi deal where Republicans would give away higher taxes and Democrats would give away their entitlements and reform them. The Democrats never intend to reform entitlements.
What's so perfect about the tax rate now, or overall tax plan now, the amount of revenue it might raise, that we should say we're never going to raise taxes, we're never going to increase net taxes?
Well, taxes are too high and spending is too high. step one is don't raise taxes, because the total tax burden and the total spending burden should be significantly lower. For most of American history, it's been much lower. I mean, 1, 2, 3%, 4%.
Right. Okay, well, since about 1950, and you know, it gets dicey in the past couple of years, but you know, we're looking at the federal level, tax revenue as a percentage of GDP is around 17, 18%.
Yes.
Is that the, you know, the moral number? Is that metaphysical certitude that it should never be more than that?
Well, it should never be more than that, because it should be significantly less than that. And this is.
And when you say significantly less, how much less?
I'm with Samuel Gompers. Less. Okay. Less. And when we have less, less. Okay. Fabian, small government person. Mm-hmm. There's no number. There's no floor under which I'd say, oh my goodness, you can't cut the government any more than that. The government was bloated in 1852. Okay. Mm-hmm. So when you deal with the pledge. The pledge is step one in a two-step process. First, don't raise taxes. Second, spend less.
Okay. Republicans don't want to, you know, they don't want to raise taxes, but they also don't want to cut spending. They have been party to vast, you know, increases in federal spending, certainly. And under Bush, total federal spending, when he had a Republican Congress, went up something like 60, 65%. Overall, adjusted for inflation. So what kind of spending cuts do we need to have? I mean, on your website, you say categorically, spending should be, government should be spending less than it currently does. How much less?
Well, you can reform government over time rather easily compared to cutting it X by tomorrow morning. And that is, and this is where I think the Ryan plan is a good outline. You block grant the major welfare means-tested programs, as we did in 96 with aided families with dependent children. You do food stamps, you do jobs programs.
What's good about block granting?
Well, it puts a cap on how much you're spending. Sends it out to 50 states. 50 states can figure out how to spend the money more effectively and how to save less.
Right.
With one national welfare program, it's hard to tell whether that program is hurting or helping, because everybody in the country is affected the same way. You have 50 ones, it's easier to see. California is working and Texas isn't, or vice versa, and you can see what works and what doesn't work. With Medicare, they do the premium program, which also saves a great deal of money over time. Oh, you know, by 2040, you take spending from 23, 24% of GDP down to 16% of GDP, and declining. So is that enough? Is it fast enough? Not necessarily, but every single Republican in the House, save two guys, has voted for that plan. That is the modern Republican Party's position.
Well, let's talk about specific cuts, though. I mean, because, you know, the economy isn't going to be around in 40 years if we're, you know, if it takes that long, we're screwed.
We need to pass the Ryan plan in the next 4 years.
Okay, and then what can we be cutting now? I mean, we've had $4 trillion deficits in a row. What do we need to be cutting spending on? I mean, the out of the three big ticket items, Medicare and Social Security and defense, you know, should we be cutting these now or putting in place the restraints that need to be there?
Yes. But I would argue that in each case, reform is a better way to go than quote-unquote cutting. I'd much rather take Social Security and turn it into a defined contribution plan than chop it 10 or 20% across the board. First of all, the one just irritates people, and it doesn't, at the end of the day, make it self-sustaining. A 401k where people save their FICA taxes and then have money when they retire.
And with something like that, how do you pay for people who are already in the system? You just figure out a way to do that?
Well, what Chile did was they floated a bond to cover it. I mean, there are different ways to do it. I'm in favor of the way to get as fastest to the most people owning their own 401ks rather than trusting the government for their retirement, to de-link your retirement from government power, to de-link your health care in old age from government power.
And you talked a bit about Medicare. What about defense spending? I mean, you're a high-profile Republican who is in favor of cutting defense spending, right?
Sure.
Or military spending.
Absolutely.
How do we do that as quickly and effectively as possible?
When the Democrats and some Republicans get more money, they put it into retirement benefits. That's never stopped an Al-Qaeda guy. More bases in the United States doesn't necessarily do that. There are a whole series of reforms that need to be made. Procurement reforms. This is what Rumsfeld, the big tragedy of Rumsfeld, was he came in to wrestle the retirement and procurement to the ground, and he got sidetracked with the desire to occupy Iraq and Afghanistan.
And you believe those were have been disastrous.
Well, let me start this way. The overthrowing the Taliban and overthrowing the Ba'athist regime in Iraq were not necessarily bad ideas. I didn't oppose them at the time, and they didn't cost very much money. But then staying and occupying the place for 10 years and deciding we were going to turn it into Kansas, that was expensive in lives and in our, we're a weaker country compared to other countries because of that decision. It has harmed our standing as a power and our capacity to exercise power when necessary in our own defense. So spending more money doesn't necessarily buy you more defense any more than giving the teachers union more money gets kids educated or handing out welfare makes people better off. And conservatives need to look at the Defense Department the way they do all the rest of government. It's nice that it's actually mentioned in the Constitution. That's a plus. But at the same time, there's no reason to waste money or spend it unnecessarily in that zone. I think you've got a Republican Party that's rethinking the occupations of Iraq and Afghanistan. I asked three congressmen on a panel that Cato ran a couple years ago, in a private conversation, what percentage of Republicans in the House would say that the decision to stay and occupy Iraq was a mistake? And all three said all. And I said, wait a minute, let me restate the question. I said it again, I thought they misunderstood. All, in private, all would tell you that was a mistake.
Why won't they say that in public?
That was sort of too close to the Bush administration, and at one point that was Bush's war, and there was this bizarre notion the Democrats supported the war in Bosnia and Yugoslavia, and Republicans thought it was outrageous, and then Republicans supported Afghanistan and Iraq, and Democrats thought it was outrageous. I mean, if you're really in favor of wars on a partisan basis, have you thought it through in terms of the nation's needs?
Well, this seems to be the case, though. I mean, that predictably, if one party occupies the White House, then the other party in Congress is against that war, and vice versa, which is probably one of the reasons why defense spending is up something like 70% since 2000.
Suggest people are not giving it serious thought.
Well, let's, to come back to the fiscal cliff, how is this going to play out, according to you? I mean, because we got John Boehner, it seems like he is sweating bullets and he's trying to throw more and more pieces of bacon at Obama to go after. How does the fiscal cliff end?
I have recommended, and they haven't taken my recommendation to date, that they have all negotiations be on C-SPAN.
Right.
Because exactly what you said is happening. Boehner is making these recommendations. You have no idea. It's a black box, what the Obama people are tantalizing with. And so it just sounds like Boehner's busy conceding, which may be what's happening, but it's not clear. Because they played the same game with him 2 years ago on the debt ceiling thing. And he wasn't taken to the cleaners, and he got what he wanted. So I hesitate to immediately jump in and say, because the White House put out a press release on X, Boehner did X. That said, there are a series, this is not a fiscal cliff. This is a very bumpy road with a bunch of bumps in the road. There is the January 1st effort, when the Obamacare tax increases begin. The Bush tax increases go away unless something is done, and we get the sequester of $1 trillion plus of savings, unless Congress undoes
that. Which seems to be pretty
that.
Much off the table, right? I mean, it seems like that the sequester cuts, which of course were put in last summer's budget deal or in 2011, nobody's talking about rescinding those cuts, which is a good thing.
It's
right?
Very good thing. And you saw Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader in the Senate, say, we are not raising taxes to stop the sequester.
Right.
The Republicans have already said, if you want to come up with a different way to save money as in the same guaranteed manner the sequester does, we'll talk about it. But the number stays.
Mm-hmm.
And the conservatives, including the hawks and the House, have all said the number stays. And since the D's have no interest in changing the structure, I think that's the one good piece
of
this.
So what will happen on January 1st? Taxes will go up?
I think Obama's planning on driving us over the cliff for the following reason. He needs an excuse for the failure of the next 4 years. Mm-hmm. And if we go over the cliff and even scramble back in days or weeks or a few months, and at the end of the day, nobody's taxes actually change in 2013 with withholding, he will still run around going, well, the lousy economy of my second term, which I can no longer blame on Bush because people are laughing at me, I now blame on going over the cliff. Because what's going to happen is you have $1 trillion plus of Obamacare taxes, you have hundreds of billions and trillions of dollars of regulations being dumped on the economy. They had 4 years of writing regulations that they didn't tell anybody about, and they're now coming down like a hailstorm, and it's going to be very bad.
And so this is beyond the Obamacare stuff that's coming online now.
In
we're starting to
that,
learn
yes.
Dodd-Frank and things like that.
Energy stuff, the one thing the president bragged about was energy going up, and his regs will now tamp that down.
Here, you know, your power is more clearly in the Republican Party. Is it time for Boehner to go? Or, you know, because even when you talk about the debt reduction or the debt ceiling deal that was cut in 2011, that's a pretty awful deal where we'll give you $2 trillion in bumping up the debt ceiling in exchange. You know, we'll give that to you in the near term, very near term, for $2 trillion in cut spending, you know, over the next 10 years. I mean, this is, it's like bargaining with Wimpy for hamburgers or something like that.
Well, actually, since that is the best deal we've ever cut on increasing the debt ceiling, it's always been for free.
Right.
I like that as the Boehner rule. Now, would I like more, like present value, $2 trillion instead of $2 trillion over 10 years? Absolutely. But I think that that is now the minimum negotiating position for any debt ceiling increase in the future, and that is a good and healthy thing. Boehner and Mitch McConnell, in the middle of all this debate, have restated that that is the position of the of their caucuses. That's very, very helpful. I think, look, we need to hold the Republican majority in the House committed to a Ryan size reform, which is $6 trillion in less spending over the next decade compared to what Obama
But I mean, that's $6 trillion over the next decade out of, what, $50 trillion in expected spending. So
we're talking about going east instead of west.
Okay.
We're talking about progress, not a solution to all the world's foes. But we need a Senate that becomes as serious as the House. That could happen in 2 years. And we need a different president. Then you can actually pass some legislation. Between now and then, the Republicans who want to cut spending, maybe not all, but the ones who want to cut spending, have two levers. Debt ceiling, you want a debt ceiling increase because Obama's going to keep bumping into it. You have to give us stuff, which we did get last time, not as much as we'd like, but progress. Two, the continuing resolution, and this is the more subtle power. Because the Democrats in the Senate haven't passed a budget in three to 4 years, they do a continuing resolution. We'll just keep spending money with the following provisos. That ends March, April, and what the Republicans did and what Boehner organized 2 years ago was we will give you another 2 weeks of continuing resolution for $8 billion in discrete spending cuts, ones that you'd actually endorsed in the past. You were lying when you endorsed them, but the President Obama couldn't shut the government down to stop a teeny spending cut that he'd endorsed. And so they were going 3 yards in a cloud of dust.
Right.
The Republican freshmen were going, no, we need more, faster, and they let that lapse. What we need to do is have the discipline to take 3 yards in a cloud of dust, small, discrete spending cuts.
Now,
every
I mean, you've written and talked about how the continuing resolutions have actually been a good thing. We haven't had a budget, a real budget, in about 3 years, because it basically kept spending level or even trending down a little bit. Do you are you shaking you know, in your boots about the idea that we might actually have a budget to vote on next year? Because it will certainly be bigger than a continuing resolution.
Yes, but I will take the continuing resolution. That's one pressure point. If they actually wanted to do a budget, if the Senate wanted to do a budget, that would be very helpful, because if the D's pass the budget they want, we can beat a lot of people in 2 years. If they're willing to come down to reasonable levels that the House would agree to, then you actually can do better than a CR. But we're going to have a four-year tutorial on spending and fights on spending.
How many and we'll end with this, but how many more tutorials, four-year tutorials on spending do we need? Because, I mean, this goes back to a question, you know, Reason as a libertarian group, a lot of people are tired of the Republicans who say they're for less spending and smaller government. We saw this with George W. Bush and a Republican Congress that was, you know, totally powerful. They gave us a four-year or a six-year tutorial on how to blow out the jams on spending. Why should anybody think that the Republicans, if only, you know, the next time they'll finally learn their lesson?
No, because this is the post-Tea Party Republican Party. Reagan changed the Republican Party into the party of lower marginal tax rates. The pledge helped make it the party that will never raise taxes, period. But it then was still the party that would spend too much money. Bush never thought about reducing spending. It was never on his list of things to do. And whenever there was a crisis, they spent more money, not less. Then the Tea Party came in, and for the first time, people lost elections over spend too much. I didn't think you could lose an election over spend too much. I thought you had to wait till spend too much became tax too much, then we'd get you.
Right.
But you know, a lot, 83 freshman Republican in a year when spending was the issue, not taxes, not regulations, mm-hmm. spending. That is a Republican Party much more attuned in Washington, D.C. to spending. The appropriators have been, if not neutered, really cut back. The fact that they took away their earmark capacity. I mean, earmarks were the broken windows of big, mm-hmm. big spending. And so it is a much stronger committed party on spending. Yeah. We need the Tea Party and the Libertarians within and without the Republican Party to maintain that discipline.
Who are the leaders of the Tea Party that are in the Senate and the House of Congress? Give me two names in the Senate.
Scott, the guy who's replacing DeMint, mm-hmm. is gonna be one of the leaders on that. I would certainly Scalise, mm-hmm. The leader of the Republican Study Committee, the, mm-hmm. the caucus of right. the 60% of the Republicans who caucuses as conservatives. Johnson, Ron Johnson mm-hmm. of Wisconsin, Senator, both a Tea Party winner, a business guy, mm-hmm. and a serious player on spending. Ted Cruz, mm-hmm. Same thing out of Texas.
What about trajectory. The House? Who are the big guns in the House that are going to keep spending down?
In the House, actually watch for Ryan because he has to maintain that brand of his as the mm-hmm. spending guy, not just the tax people. And Cantor's going to want to play a role in the same zone. But if you want to know the leadership of the modern Republican Party over the next 10 years, look at the 30 Republican mm-hmm. governors. Walker took what was once considered an unreachable ceiling of Republican activism on defunding public sector unions and school choice and other things. That's now the floor. Mm-hmm. You want to run for president, you have to be at least as good as Walker, as bold and brave as Walker was. Wow. And you see Bobby Jindal in Louisiana. I mean, there are a whole series of governors that have started that process. Watch Brownback of Kansas. There is a state that's moving on all fronts. I mean, we're going to be able to judge a guy not by his promises, but by whether he's passed at the state level the kind of tax and spending restraint that we want to see in Washington, D.C. That's a lot more important than some congressman or senator who, if they ever accomplished anything, there are 50 other senators right. who did the same thing they did.
Right.
How do you know if he or she is doing stuff? Right. Governors.
Okay. Well, Grover Norquist, Ayatollah, terrorist, East German dictator, anti-tax activist. Yeah. Thanks for talking with Reason TV.
Thank you.
I'm Nick Gillespie.